Hello and a very warm welcome to the Cardiff Podcast. My name is Alistair Love. Joining me on episode 19 is Gemma Price, a woman who truly hit rock bottom when she was trapped in a very toxic and abusive relationship. Gemma used a chance encounter with a punch bag as the inspiration to fight back in epic style to set up the Boxing Pretty Boxing Club in Llanrymney that empowers, builds confidence and supports women and girls. We explore just what boxing did for her mental health and the amazing response from women across Cardiff as she set the club up. But it's so much more than a boxing club, it's a safe space in the community as you'll find out, and it's now been recognised by Cardiff Council and Welsh Government, who have funded a complete renovation, with their Llanrymney base fast becoming a modern training centre for aspiring boxers, both male and female. She's also working on a host of other projects there, and we'll definitely return to those in the future because they're very, very exciting. Gemma's story is harrowing, I have to warn you, but ultimately very inspirational. So let's get on and hear from the woman herself, who sounds very much like this.
Right, I'm with Gemma Price here. Gemma, thank you so much for coming on the Cardiff Podcast.
You're welcome.
It's really, really appreciated. I guess we should jump straight in, really. And what drove you to set up Boxing Pretty?
So Boxing Pretty started back in 2014. I had been in an abusive relationship for 10 years with my daughter's dad. And Tony, the guy that runs the boxing club, worked in the same school that I was part of. I was a family engagement officer in a primary school, held down a job, had two kids, and whilst going through probably one of the worst times of my life. And Tony said to me, he said, you need to do something productive. He said, I couldn't even stand in a supermarket queue. If someone looked at me or looked at my children, I was ready to attack them because I'd had so much built up frustration that I couldn't air to my ex-partner.
Yeah.
So for me, it was kind of coming out in the wrong kind of way. So Tony said, why don't you just have the keys to the gym, open the gym, go and put some gloves on and punch a bag. He said, just do something. Otherwise, you're probably going to land yourself in prison. It got to a point where I couldn't stand in a queue. I couldn't walk down the street because I felt everyone was looking at me.
Yeah.
So I did. I took the keys to the gym on a Friday evening, put some gloves on, punched a bag, and I think I cried for the whole hour.
Wow. Yeah.
That I was there just punching.
Yeah.
Seven shades of,
yeah,
out of a punch, yeah, bag. And it was just the best release ever. And I, yeah, thought, if I feel like this, there's got to be other women,
yeah,
that feel the same. And it turns out there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
So I said to Tony, I was like, can I do a girls class? And he was like, nope, there's no place for girls in a boxing gym. And I was like, come on. And he's like, if you can get six people, you can do a class. He said, I'll run a class for you. So I was literally phoning all my friends. I was like, look, I've got to prove a point to you. I need, yeah, you all to turn up. And they did, and they really enjoyed it. And the class grew and grew, and I thought, right, I'm going to do a women's fight night. And Tony was like, that's never going to work. You are never going to get women to fight in a ring for a charity night. It's never going to work. And I was like, right, let me prove you wrong. I was always told no, 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 no. And I was like, I'm at a point in my life where no wasn't happening. It wasn't, yeah, happening. So I booked a venue, booked the ring. Tony agreed to train the girls for me. And we went into a 10-week camp where we learned to box,
yeah,
we sparred. And then I ordered 250 tickets because that's how much the venue held. And I was like, oh my gosh. I looked at the pile and I was like, these, yeah, are never going to sell. Like,
yeah,
this is mental. 2 weeks, the tickets had all gone.
Wow.
It sold 10 VIP tables,
yeah,
and the tickets were gone. And then it got to the day of the fight and people were like, how do I get in? I was like, you can't, it's sold out. We'll fight if we can get in. We'll fight if we can get in. I was like, no, you can't get in. But it turned out it was like, I think we raised that night $7,000 for charity.
Great.
Just with women boxing.
Yeah,
it was,
yeah,
the best buzz ever. And I thought, right, we've done it now. I've done. I've achieved something. And then training was a Tuesday and a Friday. And then the following Tuesday, the girls were like, is training on again tonight? And I was like, pardon? They're like, we want to go again.
Oh,
we want to do it again.
Yeah.
I was like, oh my gosh. So I said to Tony, I was like, listen, I said, there's more girls. They want to go again. He was like, you've proved your point.
Mm.
He was like, let's do it. So we've done three charity nights. And I think we've,
yeah,
raised just under 15,000.
That's brilliant.
For charity. And we've,
yeah,
kept local charities as well.
Yeah.
The first one we did was for Isabel's appeal, which is Isabel was a little girl who had neuroblastoma cancer. So we raised money. She passed away, but we raised money for her foundation, which gift children like iPads or holidays. Yeah, right. So a chunk of that money went to her, and we put money into cancer research because that was something that was quite important to that group of girls training.
Yeah, sure.
Then the second one we did was for the Alfie J appeal. So Alfie J is a little boy that lives local to us, who has an undiagnosed condition. Mm. He was born healthy and happy. And then things happened and he's now wheelchair bound,
right.
Can't move, can't feed himself. And then the third one we did was for the Jamie appeal, which is for a local boy who's got scoliosis.
Mm-hmm.
That was to fund treatment for him and his family,
yeah.
To go to Great Ormond Street. So it's really worked.
And wildly successful.
Yeah. So something that was just an idea whilst I was watching George Groves fighting on the TV, thinking I'm going to start a girls' night, actually has grown from strength to strength in what it is now.
Yeah, that's amazing. So if we could rewind just a little bit then, when you were going in the teeth of this sort of abusive relationship, how sort of hopeless did you feel?
Massively, because I was always a really confident person. I had a really good job, really close to my family. Grew up, mum and dad always together, brother, really close. And then really good group of friends. And then I met him. We were introduced by a friend of mine. And in the first, probably the first 6 months or so, everything was perfect. I'd already had a little girl, and me and her dad weren't together.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'm never going to meet anyone when you've got a child. But I did. And everything was fine for like the first 6 months, as I said. And then things started to happen. You'd kind of question where I'd been or question what I was wearing or question just really small things to start off with. And then if my friends come over, that was an issue. If my mum or dad came over and announced, that was an issue. And slowly and surely, he literally picked everybody that was close to me off. So it was just me.
Yeah.
And then we had our daughter, probably 2 and a bit years into being together. And that was just when everything just went catastrophic. Because I was there. He had a hold on me. We had a child. He lived in Bristol. So he'd go back and forth to Bristol for weeks on end. But he was a drug addict. And crack was his drug.
Yeah.
So we'd bear the brunt of the come down when he'd come back. Constantly walking on eggshells. We went out one night and I literally said to a man, excuse me, at a bar. And before I knew it, I'm being dragged outside and I'm being kicked around the floor like a football. Purely because I'd said to somebody, excuse me.
Yeah.
Which, thinking back now, is ridiculous. Yeah. It's ridiculous behaviour.
That's what I mean, I think. I think when you're in the teeth of that, you don't know
and you've seen no way out.
Yeah.
Because my dad was like, just leave. And I said, I can't, it's not, everything will be fine. And I kept convincing myself everything was going to be fine. He was just going through a bad patch or I'd done something wrong. He was really good at convincing me I'd been somewhere where I hadn't. So mentally, I'd be sat there thinking, was I there? Was I not there? But it was mind games. It was massively, he was coercive and control and manipulating. And the control was the worst part. I didn't have a phone because it was just easier not to have one because then nobody could get hold of me. I had to rely on him. He took my bank card. So if we went out for dinner, we'd probably look like the perfect family, but he's paying with my card.
Yeah.
Shopping, like it was everything that he wanted. Simple things like that. Yeah. He'd order takeaway and leave my eldest daughter out. Like it was just really, really nasty.
It's so important to hear this stuff because I think there's a perception, there's always that thing, like people said to you, well, why don't you leave?
Just leave.
It's not that easy, is it?
No, it's not. The threat I had was if I leave, he was going to kill us.
Yeah.
And that wasn't, like people like, no, but he wouldn't, he would have.
Yeah.
Because that's what his mentality was. If it was just as easy to leave, he would have left probably a year and a bit into
exactly,
it.
Exactly.
But when you're in it, and I had nobody,
because
everyone had left, because not because of me, because they could see what he was turning me into.
Yeah.
And they couldn't stand back and watch that. My dad was just like, I can't speak to you. I'll speak to you when he's gone. And that was really hard because I was so close to my dad.
Yeah.
So to hear my dad say to me, actually, I'm not going to speak to you because you're choosing him, you're choosing this lifestyle. And it wasn't, I was stuck in it.
Yeah.
And I couldn't, for the life of me, figure a way out. Yeah. I used to think, I went on a suicide prevention training course with part of my job. And the guy opened up the course and was like, everyone at some point has had a suicidal thought. And I was like, that's a massively bold statement to make. And he was like, think back to your worst ever time and what were you thinking? And I sat there and I was like, oh my gosh. I used to lay in bed at night and think, I'm going to take my girls, my children, I'm going to hire a boat and I'm just going to jump. I'm going to take the two of them and me and I'm going to jump off. And he was like, that's a suicidal thought.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, no, I didn't want... And he was like, that's a suicidal thought. He said, you thought of ending your life.
Yeah.
And to me, at that point, that seemed better than living in the life we were in.
Yeah. So that was the utter desperation.
Yeah.
So going forward again then a little bit, so people like Tony, I've heard a lot about Tony, met him, obviously a character here.
Big Tom.
But so he genuinely could see what was going on.
If he hadn't pointed it out that day, at that lowest point, none of this probably would be here now.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't be here now because I don't actually know where I'd be.
Yeah.
I could quite easily have gone back because towards the end, like our relationship broke down purely because I had a phone call off a girl to say they'd had a baby.
Right.
Whilst we were together.
Yeah.
And at that point, my entire world fell apart. And it's really weird saying that because I was devastated.
Yeah.
But I spent 2 weeks then thinking, actually, this is your way out.
Yeah.
Like, what are you devastated about? Go. This is your chance.
This is
go.
Your moment.
This is your moment. Like, he's messed up. He's messed up on an epic scale. Like, you can go now. And that's what I did. And I turned my phone off. Didn't speak to him for about 2 weeks. He didn't try and contact me. But then after those 2 weeks, then I was accused of being, I was over-exaggerating by finishing with him. I was being stupid. I was letting something stupid get in the way. I was like, no, you've had a kid. Like
a kid
10 years
woman.
I put up with this. Like visited you in prison, gone up and down the country visiting you, like gone without so you can have. And I was like, no, I said, I'm not overreacting. And then it got quite serious because then he just turned up at the house unannounced, banging our door. The one time he phoned me and he was like, I'm in the train station, you need to come and get me. And I was like, no, I don't. And he was like, if you don't come, he said, I'm coming to the house. So I was like, right, okay. So I put the girls in the car, went and got him, and I could see by the look on his face, he was on a massive high. So we got to the house, and that was the time he held a knife to my throat because I was overreacting. I wasn't answering to his calls. But I stood my ground and I was like, if you're going to do it, do it.
Mm.
He'd locked the girls upstairs, but they'd got out so they could see what was going on. And I said, if you're going to do it, just do it. I said, because anything's better than just living with this hanging over me.
Mm.
And then something happened. He had a phone call and he was like, I've got to go. I've got to go. And he was like, you need to take me. You need to empty your bank and then you need to take me to the train station. I've got to go. And I was like, right, okay, like this, fine.
Yeah.
So I went and just took whatever money was in my bank account. And on the drive to the train station, there was a police car next to me. And I thought, do I just get out? Do I just get out and tell him what's going on? And he looked at me, he was like, if you do, he said, you know what's going to happen. So I was like, right, deep breaths. I was literally by the castle. I thought, right, I've only got about 5 more minutes to get to the train station. Got him to the train station. He got out of the car. I don't think he even shut the door and I was gone.
Yeah.
Like parked. I can remember parking around. It was where the old Echo printing building used to be.
Yeah.
I parked around the back and literally just sat there, slammed the doors, locked us in, and I just said to the girls that I will never let that happen to you again.
Yeah.
And I got home and something inside me just thought, no, I'm not dealing with this no more.
Mm.
And that's when the anger kicked in. Yeah. I think that was, it was good, but it also wasn't healthy. It wasn't healthy in the slight because I was damaging myself.
Yeah, right.
All because of him.
Yeah.
It was
again, people were noticing you
yeah.
outbursts.
Yeah.
And
I'm the normally the most laid back. Everything goes over my head.
Yeah.
But at that point, I was just like, I was ready to kill anyone that stood in my way, that looked at the girls, that I could see as a threat. Mm. Even though so people were a threat.
All those years of being, you know.
It was like mentally being told that you'll never amount to anything. Yeah. No one's ever going to want you. Who's going to want you? What are you going to do with your life? What are you ever going to achieve? That's still, to this day, is the hard, like bruises heal.
Mm.
Black eyes could heal. I could cover them. I could cover bruises on my body. But mentally, like I can look at all of this now and just think we're still not doing enough.
Mm.
And people are like, you need to stop, take a step back and have a look at what's going on.
Yeah, you do, but we need to take a step back in this interview because obviously you put those nights on and then the girls came to you and said, so what now?
Yeah.
So what happened then?
So we put on, so after the three nights were done, I was kind of like, we've milked this a little bit now. Let's just focus on the boxing side of it because mentally, it can have such an impact on someone's life.
Yeah.
Mentally, physically, the impact is amazing. So we focused on just putting on just two training nights. Mm. And I thought, if people come, they come. If they don't, it's no skin off our nose.
Two initial ones.
Yeah.
Just two
training nights, a Tuesday and a Friday.
Yeah.
And it was busy.
Yeah.
It was busy. We were in our little hut at the end of the road, and it was busy. And then the girls were like, can we do another night? And I was like, oh, let's just stick with two.
Yeah.
And then it would peak and then it would dip a little bit. But I think the kind of women we were getting were mums.
Mm.
Mums, women with jobs, women with families. So you expect that to happen.
Yeah.
Because life's busy.
And
I was a single mum at that point when Boxing Pretty started. So I'd say to mums, look, childcare's not an issue. Bring them with you. So we'd have mums training, we'd have like kids sat at the end of the hut.
Fantastic.
They'd start on iPads, then all of a sudden you look and they'd just be watching what was going on. Or we had like a really good outside space, they'd bring footballs with them, so they'd be outside playing football because it was like a big gated area that we had. They'd be playing football whilst their mums trained. And for some people that's, what's the word I'm looking for? I found it, I was a single parent. I didn't have anyone to look after my kids. I didn't want to rely on anyone. But I didn't want anyone to feel excluded that they couldn't. They couldn't train because of that issue. Mm. Because most gyms don't offer a crash facility. And mums miss out.
Yeah.
And it actually builds a really good sense of community.
Yeah. Yeah.
The kids all enjoy playing with each other. Mm. The mums got to train. Everyone left happy.
Yeah.
So for me, like, it's never, we have here now a gym full of kids half of the time because the mum's like, can I bring them with me? I'm like, of course you can. Like, that's the basis of this.
And they're seeing something positive, aren't they? The kids, you know.
We've got one little boy. So we started the evening classes. And then when we moved to this building, we carried on with the evening classes. And I thought, actually, I'm missing the school run mums here a little bit. So we started with a Monday morning class, which was 9:30 to 10:30. And that was really, really busy. And then the mum's like, can you put on another morning one? So we've gone from just one evening one to two mornings. And I do a class with girls aged 10 to 16, I love that.
Yeah.
But there's one little boy in the morning class who's learned to count to 10 since he's been here. He's one. Because he counts the punches that his mum's throwing.
Fantastic.
And he shouts. So Tony can shout, but this little one is shouting louder than Tony. So Tony's like, I know exactly who's taking over when I finish.
You know what's happening there.
But yeah, it's a good sense of community for the mums, and they build relationships out of it as well. Like, they go out for dinners, they go for coffees.
Well, are they aware of your story? I mean, in other words, is Boxing Pretty, is that just something that people would learn about when they get involved? Is it purely badged up as a sporting club?
I think I'm quite open in sharing my story, and quite open because I think there's a need for it.
Yeah.
There was a point where I was told I was making everything a bit about me. And I was like, oh, that kind of threw me a little bit because I'm like, you don't see me in a picture. I'll push Boxing Pretty till the day I die because I can see the benefits of it. But I think women, once they're in, they know the story. Mm. I write quite a lot about the story.
Yeah.
Because it's not talked about enough.
No, it really isn't.
It's not talked about enough. And I had a massive shame with my abuse because I felt quite hypocritical because I was working in a job where I was in charge of children on the child protection register. children going into care, as well as working with their families. So I'd have this horrific home life, and then I'd be going in trying to give people advice on how to deal with their life. And I was like, if only you knew what was... Yeah. And sometimes mums would say to me, how do you know this? I was like, if only you knew what was going on at home with me.
Yeah.
But I think until you've been in it, you can't really help people as much as you want.
No.
And I kept it from the people I work with. And my daughter attended the same school that I was working in. And the one day she brought me a key ring. She's like, oh, I've made you a key ring. Mm. I said, what do you mean you made me a key ring? And she's like, oh, the NSPCC have been in. She said, and I put my hand up and I told them the dad punches you.
Oh, God.
I was like, you've done what? And she looked, she was like, have I done something? I said, no. So you haven't done anything wrong at all. I said, it's fine. And she's like, but the thing is, mum, two other people in my class put their hand up as well. I was like, right, okay, okay. And then I was called into the head's office the next day. And she was like, why didn't you tell us? And I was like, how on earth am I supposed to come to you lot and tell you what's going on in my life? And they had no clue. And they were people I worked with for 5, 6 years.
Yeah.
No clue.
And again, that's an issue, isn't it? That you didn't feel you could go anywhere.
No,
you
know? No. Because it's such a... I wouldn't say delicate subject. I think people don't know how to, like, women that have been in a situation I've been in, some of the things you talk about are quite horrific.
Yeah.
So I don't think people are ready to listen to that.
Mm.
I think it's quite a, I'd find it really easy speaking to other survivors.
Yeah.
Because they've been through it. They can share a common theme. But if I was talking to, I don't know, just like an average person, I think, and sometimes you hold back.
Yeah.
Because you think, I can't actually tell him the full 100 of what's going on here, because actually, it's not, and I wouldn't want to put that onto somebody else.
Mm. Plus, people do default, as like we said earlier, they just default to, well, why didn't you get out?
And that's the worst thing you can say to someone.
Yeah.
It really is the worst thing you can say to someone.
Mm.
It is, because I had it constantly. Why didn't you just leave? Why didn't you, if it was that easy, I bloody would have.
Yeah, of course.
Like, but it's not. Once you're in it and you're in the thick of it, it's funny now, because now I talk about it, it's like I kind of look in a box.
Yeah.
And I'm like, if I could have just picked myself up and taken myself out of it, it would have made everything so much easier. But it's taken me a long time to get to this point where I can be as open as I am about it.
Yeah.
Without getting angry and wanting to punch someone.
Well, and that's the thing I want to turn to, in a sense, is... So you mentioned early on the mental health benefits of the boxing training. So just explain to us then, for the, I mean, obviously people are aware physical exercise is good for your mental health, you know, but what specifically about boxing?
I think because it's such an individualised sport, you don't have to talk to anyone. You can come in, put your gloves on, and just be you in a bag for like as long as you want it to be.
Yeah.
And the release you get from punching somebody, I think because survivors feel quite angry. And when you've got something that's quite constructive and controlled, and a way to release that, it automatically, mentally makes you feel better. I know in my first hour of down in the other gym, crying my eyes out, punch, I must have looked a mess. Or like I needed some kind of sectioning. But for me, that was like the best hour that I'd had in about 10 years. It was just, that for me, the release of the anger, and it's just, it's a weight that's lifted. Yeah. It's just like that.
So what was it like in the aftermath of that then? That hour of battering that?
Oh my, I wanted to stay. Yeah. I wanted to stay and just carry on. I was like, you'll be here all night if you got 10 years worth of anger out.
But was it like a light bulb going on?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For me, it was right, this is it.
Yeah.
This is the time now to switch everything around. And I had something else then to focus on. Because I'd focused so long on feeling angry and feeling like an injustice had been done and hard done by, like, poor Jem. I was like, well, what am I doing? Like, I'm not helping anyone by feeling that way.
Yeah.
So for me, it was a massive shift in my focus. I was meeting new people along the way. Like, we were putting Facebook posts out, and people were like, oh, what are you doing? Can we come along?
Yeah.
And I've met so many people in the process of it.
Yeah. And have other women presented? That sounds like a hospital. Have they turned up here with similar stories?
Yeah.
And how have they reacted?
They're not...
Because every story is different, I know.
Yeah. And I think until you've got that relationship with someone, they're not as forthcoming in talking about it. But once they're in, and they know my story. And I do a lot of blogs. So I do share quite a lot, a lot of what's going on. So kind of people sometimes come in knowing, knowing my background, knowing my story. And then they're quite happy to, I've been through similar. Sometimes they can share instantly. Sometimes it takes a while. Sometimes they'll share with somebody else in the group. It's not always me. There's so many other girls I've been coming from the beginning. They're actually quite pivotal in the whole Boxing Pretty. Movement, but that sounds like we're like some kind of
But it is a bit of a movement. It's in the best sense.
Kind of become
of
his own entity now. When I started it off, and I think because it's got a name, like Boxing Pretty, like everyone knows it. It's got a name. It's got a logo. I do probably do people's heads in, fill in their timelines with stuff. But I'm quite proud of where, from what it started as to where it's come. I'm quite proud of the fact that now it's become its own little thing. And it is, it's five training classes a week, and it's women being quite empowered, and I've seen women's body shape changing, women's confidence improving. It's massive.
So it's almost, there's a physical thing that women have got out of it, but then as you say, there's definitely, sounds like there's real mental health benefit from it.
It's just empowering, I think. It's just, and because boxing is such a male-dominated sport, that when, I think there's something quite empowering about women being in that kind of environment. And we're lucky we can shut the gym down. I've qualified now as a coach, so I can coach as well. But the girls, are, I think also as well, because survivors kind of need positive male role models as well, because not all men are evil and not all men are bad. So Tony and the guys here are just amazing. Like, they're so good with the girls that they're a massive part of it. Without them, like, I couldn't run it on my own because it's gone bigger.
And how much has it helped that, in a broader boxing sense now, the likes of Nicola Adams, it is quite mainstream now almost, isn't it?
So the Welsh Championships are coming up over the weekend, and it's amazing the amount of girls coming through. Like, we've got girls that are in our normal amateur classes here, and I just think it's so nice to see that, because for so long I think women were just, boxing was not, it wasn't deemed appropriate for them. And you just think, it's ridiculous. It's so ridiculous. I'm so glad we've come so far. But then, as you said, with the likes of Nicola Adams and the Chantal Camerons, the Natasha Jonases, they're like prime time on TV fighting. And I think for a young girl to look at that and think, actually, I could aspire to that. That's massive.
That's a total change of mindset, isn't it? In a very short time.
That's
brilliant. So you were in that hut down the road, but now we're in Llanrymney.
We're in our new building.
Llanrymney Boxing Club. And I can smell paint, and it's as you said, it's a work in progress, but it's going to look pretty special. How did that come about?
So we were in the hut, and we could hold probably about 10 people maximum. And Tony and I were like, we're outgrowing. We're outgrowing ourselves. So we got together as a coaching team. There's two other coaches as well. So we got together as a coaching team, like, right, what are we going to do? We need more space. This building was up for a community asset transfer with Cardiff Council, but it was put out to the public for consultation, what they wanted in it. And we were like, let's just go along. Let's just go and see what the building is like, see what we could do. We'll come back. We'll plan something. And originally, we only wanted the front half of this building, because at the back of the building, there's a big community hall. There was office space. We were like, you just want the front half. It's bigger than what we've got now. We can fill it. We can do well. So we partnered up with a charity called Sported. So we had a mentor called Alistair McIntyre, who was just the best. Put a business plan together. And then we were asked to present to the council what we wanted to do with the with this building. And this went on and on and on. This was about 3 years worth of work. So we still kept the hut going. We were still turning people away. So we were in the hut a lot because obviously we wanted everyone to be able to have a go. And then we were called to a meeting with the council, and they were like, we want you to take on the whole building. So we were just like, pardon me. And I literally sat there going, the whole building, the whole building. You want the whole, yes, Gemma, the whole building. I was like, right, okay. So we went back to the hut and we were like, what do we do? And we're like, let's just go for it.
Yeah.
let's just go for it. Let's just see what we can make of it. So from saying yes, we had a year to start planning. And then we got the keys and we were like, what do we do? Everything was yellow. The whole building was just yellow. Yellow doors, yellow walls. There was offices that were just random colours.
Yeah.
There was loads of offices. And we were like, what do they need them all for? And we always knew we wanted it to be a community hub. We knew that. We always knew that. And first and foremost, the boxing will always come first because that's what we were in here for.
Sure.
So we converted one office into a girls' changing room. We've converted two offices into one big fitness room, so it's like strength and conditioning stuff. We had a kitchen in the gym side, and there was a kitchen in the community hall side, the community hall, and then we had this room that we're in now. And then we were like, right, okay, so we... Good thing about boxes is they have day jobs. Mm. So we had lots of painters, decorators, plumbers, carpenters. So we like, everyone that walked in, like, what's your trade? Plumber, right, you're on the list. What's your trade? Carpenter, right, you're on the list.
Yeah.
And then we just did, like, building days. So on a Saturday, we were like, right, everyone, if you can make it down, we're just going to paint the building.
Mm.
Everything was in this room before. We let the kids loose in here. They just was like, roller in here, roller in there. And then it got to a point we had a meeting in New Orleans, and I was like, Tom, we just need to, like, we need to sort this out. It did a purpose for a while. And then we moved in properly, and we went from 10 kids per class to 40 plus kids per class. And we were like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
We haven't really advertised. We've just gone through Facebook. Yeah. And most of what we do is word of mouth.
Yeah.
Word of mouth. So we then applied for some funding with the Welsh government. And originally, we only wanted 50,000. We're like, that's enough. That's just going to get what we need then. And that's enough. So the Welsh government people come out and they're like, you do know you can apply for up to 250,000. We're like, yeah, but no, we don't want that. They're like, what do you mean you don't want that? Yeah. No, we don't want this. We're 50,000 is fine. And then we showed them around the building and they were like, right, okay. And then they sat us down. They're like, we're telling you to go in for more. And we're like, right, what do you mean? They're like, put a wish list together. Mm-hmm. Everything you want, send it back in to us. So we're like, oh, right, what should we have done? Like, we'll have all the windows changed, we'll have all the ceilings replaced, we'll knock the kitchen through, we'll have a big community kitchen. And I said to Tony, I was like, Tone, this is all coming, it's like 180 grand. He was like, send it in. I was like, right,
that's
okay.
That's what they said, yeah.
So we sent it in and we were like, oh my gosh. And then we had a visit off the chief executive of Camelot, the lottery people. So Nigel, he came down and he loved it. He loved it here. Yeah. And then he invited us up to Parliament. We had this parliamentary reception with him in December. And then we got back and I had a phone call in my car and I cut her off. And then Tony phoned me. He was like, Gemma. I said, well, what's the matter? He was like, have you had a phone call? I said, I've just cut it off. He was like, you need to answer it. I said, wait, what's the matter? He was like, we've been awarded the full 182,000. Wow. And he was like, the thing is, I phoned them back because I don't quite believe them. What do you mean? He's like, I phoned them back and I got through to the Welsh government office and I just put the phone down. And I was like, Tony. He was like, no, we'll wait for a letter. We're waiting. And he was waiting and waiting and waiting. And they sent the letter. And then you could see, like, in numbers, we were like, that's a lot of money.
That's fantastic.
That's a lot of money. And then we had a presentation night at Christmas in the hall. And we gave the kids all, like, little trophies and stuff. And then Tony was like, I'll get a speech prepared for you. I was like, what for? And he was like, well, announce how many. And I was like, I'm not saying it. And it was really nice to share with the kids of the club and the parents, like, what we were going to do. They were so supportive.
Yeah. Oh,
that's
great.
So supportive. And now they can see it. Like, they can see it in
it's
action.
It's coming together, isn't it?
Yeah, we're not just talkers, we're doers.
Yeah.
And if we want something done, we're quite proactive in that sense.
Yeah.
So if we want it done, we're going to do it.
Yeah.
So it is like a building site.
So what happens now then? Obviously, this money's been, the work is
so
ongoing.
So once the work's done, we're going to have a proper launch.
Yeah.
But there's so many projects we've got already that are booked in.
All right.
Yeah. We're doing a project with Cardiff Homeless Service. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have an 8-week pilot project with them where they're going to bring their rough sleepers here.
Yeah.
So they're going to do an hour of boxing. So increasing their physical fitness as well as their mental fitness. And then in the hall, they're going to have what are they called? Mental health nurses. It went off my head then. They have mental health nurses, nutritionists, a GP, just for them to get some extra support on site. Brilliant. We've got showers and stuff, so we said if they want to shower, they're more than welcome to shower here. Our kitchen will be done by then, so we're going to cook food on site for them to take with them. Mm. And that's going to be a pilot with them. And then Cardiff Homeless Service has said if that's successful, which I think it will be, because I don't think it's been done before, there's other rough sleepers, and then there's other homeless people.
Yeah.
Because I didn't realise how many types of homeless there are.
Yeah.
And the one category of homeless is women fleeing domestic violence, which I was like,
of course.
Brilliant. Yeah. Bring them in.
Yeah.
Bring them in. That's, so that's one link we've got. And then we've also had a meeting to run a project with patients with dementia.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
With Landock Hospital.
Right.
And we do lots of work with the police, with children with ASB.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing a project with South Wales Police and Tiger Bay Boxing Club. Yeah. So we're going to link the two communities together.
Yeah.
And we're doing a 15-week project with children who are low level at risk of becoming excluded from school. So we're going to do boxing here, and then do lots of self-development stuff for a 15-week project. So we're doing that with Eastern High.
Yeah, fantastic.
So yeah, there's lots of stuff going on.
And we've measured our time to speak to me. There's so much going on.
It's busy. It is busy.
Yeah.
But I think we see the benefit that it has.
Yeah.
And that's what keeps us going.
Yeah. Well, look, you've named all those different groups, homeless and women who've been fleeing domestic violence, and just any, normal people that not... Normal's the terrible phrase to use in that context, but you know what I mean, people going about their lives, the benefits are extraordinary, aren't they?
Yeah.
So that's just amazing.
That's what we keep saying, we're more than just a boxing club.
Yeah.
Because boxing's evolving, and it's becoming, you see it on the news, boxing's being used to combat knife crime, to tackle gang crime.
Yeah.
It's being used in such a productive way that people are seeing it more now than just people getting in a ring and smashing each other in. It's not about that. Like, if people see the discipline of it.
Yeah.
Like, the pros that are out there training, they train there now, and a lot of them go back to their full-time jobs. Mm. But people think because they're professional fighters, they're on all this money, and their lives are easy. They don't see this graft that they put in, as well as working a full-time job, as well as then training in the evening. And some of them have got families.
I think a lot of people don't see that, do they?
No.
They don't. Most
Unless
don't.
You are like the big Anthony Joshua's or the big Dillian White. We had him here, Dillian White. He's lovely.
Yeah.
Unless you're on big money like they are, you can't make it a full-time profession unless, obviously, you've got the backing of sponsors and stuff.
Tiny minority, isn't it? Get that far.
Yeah.
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 Oh, that's amazing. So what about yourself then? You know, you've bounced back from probably as bad as it can get, really, for a human being in our society. So this has played a big part. I mean, what are you doing with your life now, though? If there is an outside of this, I'm not sure there is.
This is my life 24/7. Even my kids are like, we're at the gym again. Life is well different to what it was. It's way different. I've got such a good relationship back with my dad, my friends, my mum, my girls. My main focus was on my children and ensuring that, because they went through a lot, even though people think, I thought I sheltered them from a lot of stuff, but it turns out they've seen a lot more than I thought they did. So my main focus was not on me, was on making sure that actually they grow up to be quite stable. And I wanted them to realise that that's not, you don't have to put up with that, just because I did. And I felt a massive guilt because I was their mum and I was meant to protect them. Yeah. But I went on a community ambassador training course with Women's Aid. And I explained that. I said, I feel a lot of guilt. And they were like, that's not your guilt to carry, though. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, but it is. I'm the mum. And they were like, it's not your guilt to carry. Mm-hmm. That's his.
Yeah.
You're holding on to it when you don't need to. So, yeah, I was making sure that they're pretty stable. But they're good girls. They're, considering what they've been through, they are absolutely phenomenal. Like, they're mental, but they are really good kids.
Yeah.
Then I left my job. and went to uni at 36. That was interesting. Yeah. 36 and going to university full of like 18 and 19 year olds. I'm like, Mama Gem.
Mama Gem.
I have the messages I have, Gem, what are we doing? I'm like, no, you should have been there listening.
Yeah.
I'm such a geek. Honestly, I am.
What are you studying?
Sport management in Cardiff.
Well, that's just as well, I reckon, isn't it?
So yeah, and it's because I obviously live this.
Yeah.
And the lecturers kind of know that I live this.
Yeah.
So I'm just like prime example every time. Jabby, you give an example from... I'm like, no.
How useful... This just is want a really to ridiculous question. How useful has that been, sports management, to what you do?
Massively.
Here?
Massively.
Isn't it nice that it practically fits into your life?
Yeah. I think I always knew I wanted to go to uni, but it was never the right time. It was never... I was never in a position to be able to do it. And then I just thought, actually, do you know what? If I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it. My daughter was starting high school. She was starting year 7.
Mm.
My other daughter was year 9. So I was like, they're going to be able to get a bus home if I'm going to be a bit late.
Yeah.
Now's the time. And I thought, if I don't do it, I realised that I was helping certain children in the school I was working in. And in my head, I was thinking, if I can get them to year 6, then I'll leave. And my dad was like, why? He said, they're not your concern.
Yeah.
He said, why are you not putting yourself first? And I was like, right, okay. And then I seen the sport management degree and I was like, that would be perfect.
Yeah.
And I was like, right, let's just apply. And I think I applied to the UCAS application the same day in work. And I didn't tell anyone I was leaving. I was just like, I just want to go. We're no fuss. I don't like fuss. Just like, I'm just going to slip out the door.
Sure, mother.
Just going to slip out the door, slip out the door at the end of the summer term and not come back. And that's pretty much what I did.
Yeah.
I emailed my boss and I was like, I'm not coming back.
Mm.
And it was just like, again, then that was another weightlift. And I thought, right, there was one last thing I had to do. And that was, which people are like, you did what? So I contacted Kendall's dad, who's my little girl.
Yeah.
So he was the one that put us through the situation we were in.
Yeah.
And invited him for dinner. We went out for lunch and I thought, I'll go out somewhere where there's lots of people because if anything happens, at least I'm covered. And I literally sat there and just said to him, I forgive you.
Mm.
I forgive you for everything that you've done. Everything you've done, everything you put me through, it's done. And he was like, confused. And he was like, how can you do that? I bought him lunch and I was like, because I said, if I don't forgive you, he said, I'm sat at home every night, absolutely fuming with what you've done to me. I said, and who's that going to help?
Mm.
It's not helping anyone. It wasn't productive. It wasn't beneficial to anyone. Me being sat on my sofa thinking, I'm going to kill him for this. I'm going to kill him. And I was just like, I just have to forgive him.
Yeah.
And that was like, bumf, it's done.
Yeah.
And for me, that was the line under everything. Wow. That was the... It's done.
How did you come to that moment where you thought you had to do it, though? What?
Because I was tired of just having this knot constantly.
Yeah.
And when I'd sit and think about it, it was because everything was just playing over and over in my head, and I was like, I just need to get it off my chest. He's not concerned that I'm sat at home absolutely fuming. He's got on with his life.
Yeah.
He's got on, he's moved on, he's had girlfriend after girlfriend, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I was like, it was just for me, it was the final part.
Mm. And how did he react?
He was shocked.
And did he have an awareness of what he'd done?
He said sorry.
Right.
He said sorry because he knew. He knew what he was doing was wrong. He knew what he'd done was wrong.
Yeah.
But I think actually confronting it head on was kind of what we both needed.
Yeah.
And I just said to him, I said, I just hope you never put anyone else through what you've put me through. And we kind of left it at that.
God,
but that was the whole, that was the turning point. Yeah. That was the right, that's done now. It's like, you know, when you box things off, that's boxed and done. That's done. And I got home that day and you know, when you think, I feel about 4 stone lighter because this whole weight that was just playing on my mind was just gone.
Yeah.
And it was that day. I was like, you're never going to control me ever again.
Mm.
You're never going to tell me what to do ever again. And like, even in the days when we'd finished and things were quite bad, my stomach would still knot if he phoned me.
Yeah.
And there's none of that now.
It's not healthy, is
if
it?
If he phones and he's in a certain mood, I'm like, I'm not speaking to him. And I'll just put the phone down. And it's funny that I got like the backing of all of these lot. So God help him if he tried anything. He'd have all of these lot on his case.
Very advisable, would it?
No, but we're in a different position now. And people are like, how could... Like, he's still Kendall's dad. He still has a responsibility to be your dad. So last... 2 weeks ago, she went to stay with him for the first time. She's 12.
Yeah.
She went to stay with him, or with his mum, her nan.
Yeah.
And he didn't really bother with her.
Mm.
But she did it, and I was quite proud of her. Yeah. I'm not going to stop her from wanting a relationship with her dad.
No.
But the same, like, what he did to me, he did to me.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's my place to stop her from pursuing a relationship. She's not daft. She'll know whether it's what she wants. She'll figure it out herself, but it's not for me to say, no, you can't do that. That's not my place. I'm a mum and I'll be there to pick up the pieces at the end of it, but I'm not going to stop it.
It speaks everything of how you've bounced back from what happened to you, that you can approach it like this.
Yeah.
That's absolutely brilliant. And on that note, really, and you may not have any advice, but you know how, from your own experience, it's unspeakable, the situation you found yourself in. Is there any advice you could give to someone? Because you saw yourself how desperately hopeless it felt. What would you give any advice?
I just think just find someone that you can confide in and talk. Talk. Tell someone you don't want advice. You just want someone to listen.
Yeah.
And I think that's... I'm lucky I had Tony.
Yeah.
I am so lucky. He doesn't... He goes, oh, shut up. Shut up.
He knows.
Not my fault. Shut up. Shut up. He knows.
Yeah.
But yeah, just talk. Yeah. Be honest. Be open. And talk. Because there is support out there. Mm. Like, Women's Aid used to phone me. If he was in prison and phone me and be like, we can move you. And I was like, no, it's not that bad. It'll be fine. Because I always thought there was people worse off than me. Like, you don't... My situation was bad, but I got out of it alive.
Yeah.
And that's the way I will always see. I got out of it alive. Mm. Yeah, things happened.
Yeah.
I probably might not have been alive had it gone on any longer.
Yeah.
But I'm lucky I survived. Mm. There's people that don't. But there is support out there. There's help out there. There's a lot of support out there. I think the biggest thing people find is financially, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
But that can all be dealt with. Everything can be dealt with. If you feel that unsafe, there's support out there. Bloody hell, come here. Come here, come to me, I'll help.
Definitely come here, yeah.
Come to me, I'll help.
But, so obviously you mentioned Women's Aid. Would they, for people, say, who haven't got anyone to turn to, would they be a good first step?
There's a helpline.
Yeah.
There's a free helpline that's open 24/7. They can offer legal advice. Yeah. They offer support. They can find you a refuge to go to.
So there's a way, really.
There's always a way.
Yeah.
There is always a way, and there's always a way out of it. Mm. Don't feel you have to stay. And don't stay for the sake of your children, because it doesn't help.
No. Well, I think that's a brilliant place to stop. And this is it's an inspirational place, and it's been fantastic speaking to you. You're going to have to come on again, because
I don't know,
five of those projects you mentioned. that'd be interesting. So I want to see how all that pans out.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to what's to come.
God, it's really exciting.
In the mix of it, I mean, I'm like, what's happening?
Yeah.
But and people keep saying to me, it'll be nice when it's done. I'm like, yes. Me and Tony feel like we're literally clutching at straws a minute.
But you will get there. I know you will
It will get there, and it'll all be worth it, as people keep telling me, when you're living in this.
But Gemma Price, that's been absolutely fantastic.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much.
And you are coming on again, I'm telling you.
No problem. Cheers. Thank you.
I think you'll agree Gemma is one inspirational woman, and it was a privilege to talk to her about her life and boxing pretty. I wish her all the luck in the world, not that she needs it, and I look forward to hooking up with Gemma again on the podcast to see how some of these critical projects are going. Please rate and review the podcast, and join me next time when I catch up with Welsh Great British Bake Off contestant John Jenkins to explore just what it's like to go into that famous tent. But for now, thanks for listening.